Part 2. 6. Suiting up for battle. Landing in Tel Aviv on May 22, 2017, Trump strode down a red carpet to the triumphal sound of a military band and vowed to bring peace to the Middle East. He toured Jerusalem's Old City, visiting the Church of the Holy Sepulchre to honor Christians and placing a prayer in the Western Wall, where he put his palm on the ancient stones while wearing a yarmulke in solidarity with Jews. Over dinner with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Trump sketched the broad outlines of a peace plan between Israelis and Palestinians and declared newfound resolve to confront Iran. The hastily rehearsed words coming out of his mouth all day were about the unending conflict in the Middle East. But Trump's mind was focused on the mushrooming special counsel investigation into his campaign. Trump's aides knew he needed to hire a seasoned member of the white-collar defense bar with experience in both law and political combat. The trouble was that most of the pros did not want to represent him. Trump's search for representation became a haphazard and painful obstacle course, made more difficult by the competing loyalties, false promises, and backstabbing within his team. Trump was insecure about his worth as a client and feared personal exposure, which both infected his work as president and drove him to want to thwart the investigation. The most powerful man in the world could not get a lawyer. On May 22nd, Trump placed a call from the Middle East to Mark Kasowitz, asking him to officially saddle up as his lawyer. Kasowitz had long been the president's dragon slayer, the attorney who for years had represented Trump in his business and personal matters, including a series of bankruptcies and the fight to keep his divorce record sealed. Aggressive and wily, Kasowitz had championed tough cases for Trump and won. He also had represented two of Trump's children, Ivanka and Donald Jr., against accusations of fraud. Trump trusted the street fighter and wanted him in his corner right away. Although he would still need to recruit lawyers with a specialized set of skills navigating Washington crises, which the New York-based Kasowitz lacked. Kasowitz agreed, but he soon faced a mutiny from some of his law partners. The white-haired, 64-year-old litigator had built an intensely profitable firm and wooed major Wall Street players and corporations by pledging to outwork stodgier white shoe firms. He was a rainmaker, but his firm, Kasowitz Benson Torres, had already been singed by its association with Trump during the 2016 campaign. After Kasowitz threatened the New York Times for reporting on sexual assault allegations against then-candidate Trump, some of the firm's bigger corporate clients, including those with women as key in-house lawyers, complained. Several of the firm's liberal-leaning partners were personally aghast when Trump won the presidency, but they recognized the possible financial upside to being of counsel to the president. That optimism of those lawyers ended dramatically after May 17th, when Mueller was appointed special counsel to investigate election interference and any links or coordination between Trump or his campaign associates and a hostile foreign power. The partners were mindful that their share of hefty yearly profits depended on Kasowitz's prodigious talents as a rainmaker, yet they feared the firm's bottom line could take a hit if Kasowitz took on a highly public role defending Trump in the Mueller probe. The anxiety was compounded by the fact that Kasowitz, a commercial lawyer, lacked the legal chops for a white-collar, Major League Washington scandal. But Kasowitz had something almost no one else did, not even some of the most senior people in the White House, Trump's trust. Kasowitz imagined assembling a dream team to shield the president. He and one of his partners, Mike Bow, the 50-year-old son of a fireman with conservative leanings whose hard-charging gut instincts Kasowitz trusted, set out to recruit an experienced scandal lawyer. The first few outreaches to top legal talent ended in rejection. But one offered to help for free, John Dowd. On May 18th, Beau was in his New York office near Times Square when he got an email from Dowd. "Happy to help DJT quietly behind the curtain. I am not sure he needs counsel, but it would not hurt to keep an eye on it and independently advise him. I know Bobby Mueller," wrote Dowd, who attached a New York Times article reporting that Trump's advisors were urging him to hire a D.C.-based attorney. Beau told Dowd he'd think about it and talk it over with his partner. The early reaction of seasoned pros to Kasowitz's outreach foreshadowed the difficulty to come. Kasowitz called Brendan Sullivan, the creme de la creme of the white-collar criminal defense bar. He offered to help make recommendations, but told Kasowitz he couldn't take Trump on as a client. On May 23rd, news broke that Trump had retained Kasowitz. The next day, Dowd wrote again to Beau, "Great news. Happy to help pro bono anytime." Dowd, 76, was a legal legend whose best years had been two decades prior. A former Marine, he had served in the JAG Corps and become a captain in the Vietnam era. He joined the Justice Department, where in the 1970s he led the strike force on organized crime, taking on hired hitmen and mobsters. Beau and Dowd had formed a friendship consulting with each other on some cases representing Marines whom they felt were getting the shaft from their command. The two lawyers liked each other and had much in common, both macho Irishmen and dogged fighters for their clients. Beau figured Dowd could play a supporting role on Trump's legal team. Dowd knew well the inner workings of the Justice Department and also had a lot of contacts in Washington. On May 25th, he emailed Beau yet again to say he was on his way to New York on the Acela for an event that evening at the Intrepid Museum on the Hudson River and offered to meet up. Beau told him to swing by at 4 p.m., and he would introduce him to Kasowitz. The three men met briefly in Kasowitz's office. "Good to meet you, John," Kasowitz said as they parted, saying he thought there might be a place for him on the team. "Mike will let you know." That Memorial Day weekend, shortly after 7 a.m. on Sunday, May 28th, the president fired off a tweet storm ranting about news coverage of his troubles. He was particularly incensed at a May 26th Washington Post story still dominating the headlines, claiming his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, had suggested a back channel to the Russians during the campaign. The story had spawned media commentary about whether Kushner had committed treason, making the president's son-in-law radioactive and feeling as if he were the victim of a lynch mob. Trump decried leaks from inside his own White House as fabricated lies and posited that journalists made up sources, adding, hashtag fake news is the enemy. Trump wanted fighters defending him on television and devising legal methods to derail the investigation, but so far, only Kasowitz and Beau were on board. Trump summoned two trusted hands to pay him a visit, Corey Lewandowski and Dave Bossy, his former campaign manager and deputy campaign manager, respectively. Both men were political brawlers, the kind of operative Trump most admired, and Bossy was well-versed in navigating Washington scandals, having worked as a senior Republican House investigator during the Clinton presidency, leading congressional probes into Whitewater and other matters. Trump wanted to know if Lewandowski and Bossy were interested in joining the administration and running the war room operation. The pair had already met with Reince Priebus and Steve Bannon about just that proposition, and everything seemed set. But Trump changed his mind. He told Lewandowski and Bossy, "I don't want you guys to come here, and then when I fire everybody, you're part of that." That same day, Kasowitz and Beau had left their home base in New York for Bedminster, New Jersey, to meet up with Kushner and Ivanka Trump to travel from the president's private golf club to Washington together. The couple were rattled by the back channel's story and wanted their advice. Before arriving in Bedminster, Kasowitz had confided to others about his growing concerns about Kushner's presence inside the White House, telling them Kushner might have to leave due to the complications his Russian contacts created. When he and Beau arrived, Kushner complained about the scrutiny and claimed the Post story was inaccurate. As he would argue repeatedly, Kushner said the Russians asked him for the back channel, and he was confident he had done nothing wrong. Kushner and Ivanka Trump also asked Kasowitz and Beau to help them calm down the president. The couple complained the West Wing was a circus, horribly mismanaged by Priebus and Bannon. Meanwhile, Priebus and Bannon were hard at work on what they knew the president would consider the most important pillar, a television-ready spokesman to lead the Trump defense. They were working from a deficit because Mike Dubke, who had helped lead the White House's response to such crises as the firing of James Comey, had just resigned as communications director in his third month on the job. After Memorial Day, Bannon met with Mark Corallo, a seasoned Republican operative whom Trump's advisors had unsuccessfully tried to get to join the communication shop at the start of the administration. Corallo, 51, was an Army veteran who had worked at the Justice Department during the George W. Bush administration, giving him a base of knowledge about criminal probes that could prove valuable. He also had the look that Trump would want in his front man. Wiry and fit, with close-cropped silver hair and tailored suits. Corallo counted Mueller and Comey as former colleagues. He explained that he had admired Comey at first. Over time, however, Corallo said he came to see Comey as a sanctimonious phony. Comey had a habit of tut-tutting and frowning at anyone who disagreed with him, Corallo told Bannon. Comey would lecture with a little eye roll, which Corallo said had one message. I'm just really disappointed in you. Your moral compass is askew. I wouldn't trust him as far as I could throw his 6'8" frame, Corallo told Bannon. Oh, wow, that's interesting, Bannon said. So you must know Mueller, too. Corallo began to gush. Oh, I love Bob. He walks on water. Really? Bannon said. I have very few heroes in life that are not ballplayers, and former Attorney General John Ashcroft and Bob Mueller are at the top of the list, Corallo replied. If you have to have a special counsel, there is nobody better than Bob Mueller. If there's nothing there, there will be a report that says there's nothing there. He's your golden ticket. Bannon and Priebus then wanted to take Corallo to meet Trump. It was in the middle of the afternoon. I don't have a tie on, Corallo said, surprised. In the George W. Bush administration, the president's schedule had been tightly choreographed, weeks ahead of time, and nobody popped in to see him unless it was urgent, and certainly not on a weekday without a tie. But such formalities did not matter to Trump. Off they went, down the hall and to the president's private dining room, where the television was on and Trump was perusing a stack of papers. He was warm and gracious to Corallo, and they got down to business. Bannon explained to Trump that Corallo knew Mueller well, and Trump said, I'm all ears. Here's the deal, Mr. President, Corallo told him. If you're going to get a special counsel, you couldn't get a better guy. Mr. President, Jim Comey and Bob Mueller, despite what you might think, they're not best friends. There is no conflict. And Bob Mueller is the most honest guy in town. You've got to understand, this guy is a public servant's public servant. He's only interested in facts. He doesn't have a political axe to grind. He's not for you or against you when it comes to the law. He really is as honest a human being as this country's ever produced. Oh, I don't know, Trump said. This whole thing. His words trailed off. I don't blame you, Corallo said. I understand that it would be uncomfortable. But I do believe at the end of the day, if there's nothing there, you'll get a clean bill of health. And if it comes from Robert Mueller, it's unassailable. Trump seemed to enjoy the practical, cut-to-the-chase way Corallo spoke, but not to be convinced that Mueller was trustworthy. Trump asked him to return later that day to join a meeting about the Russia investigation for what would be Corallo's first time in the Oval Office. He felt chills as he took a seat across the Resolute desk. Trump railed about the Mueller investigation, how unfair it was to him, how persecuted he felt. But Corallo was thinking, Reagan sat there, FDR sat there, Truman sat there, Ike sat there. Corallo immediately hit it off with Trump's lawyers, especially Beau, a practicing Catholic about the same age who also grew up in New York's blue-collar outer boroughs. Corallo agreed on the spot to work for Kasowitz and Beau as communications strategist for the president's outside legal team. He had one condition. I will never say anything untoward about Bob Mueller. I will never attack him personally. Ain't gonna happen. And if I'm asked to, I'm out of here. And if anyone on this team attacks him personally, I'm out of here. Kasowitz and Beau agreed. They would never malign Mueller's integrity or motivations. Still without a prominent Washington attorney, Trump was vulnerable. He did what he often did at anxious moments. He grabbed the wheel. Trump thought there might be a way to play to Mueller's patriotism and convince him the investigation needed to end quickly because it was hurting the president and therefore weakening the United States in the view of adversaries around the world. Go see Mueller. You gotta go see him, Trump instructed Kasowitz and Beau several times. Tell him this is really impairing my ability to function as president. Let's find out what this is. Maybe we can get out in front of it. This was a classic Trump method for fixing problems. He thought he could talk his way out of anything by cultivating a personal relationship and working out the problem man to man. After Trump learned that Corallo knew Mueller from their work together in the Justice Department, he was elated. Trump at once asked Corallo to talk to Mueller on his behalf. Corallo's eyes widened with trepidation. He thought to himself, no way. Kasowitz spoke up and told Trump, absolutely not. That's totally inappropriate and legally unsound, Kasowitz told the president. Mark is not a lawyer. Then the president invoked Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis, who stood out in the administration because of his reputation for honor. He thought that because they were both Marines, Mattis might engender sympathy in Mueller. Trump told his lawyers to tell Mueller, General Mattis says this is a problem. Bannon and Priebus shared their view that it was best to steer clear of Mueller for the immediate future. But Beau gave them some advice. Don't assume you can always corral Trump. I don't know if you fish, Beau told them. Sometimes you have to let the line run. You run the risk of having the line snap if you pull it in all the time. You can't reel him in constantly. You can't say no to him every time. As its public face, Trump's legal team also included Jay Sekulow, whom Trump hired in late May. A lawyer with deep ties to Washington's conservative establishment, Sekulow, 60, was chief counsel to the American Center for Law and Justice, host of a radio talk show, and a longtime commentator on Fox News Channel and the Christian Broadcasting Network. He also was close to Sean Hannity, the Fox host and Trump friend. The president had been impressed at Sekulow's telegenic qualities and how well he thought on his feet. He felt the smooth-talking, savvy Sekulow could lend credibility to his defense in the media, as well as help him navigate the political scene. By now, Dowd had made his way onto the president's team, and he recommended they consider also hiring Ty Cobb, a Hogan-Lovells partner and veteran of independent counsel investigations back in the Clinton years. Dowd knew Cobb from their previous careers at Justice and their overlapping work in a massive Wall Street insider trading case. Cobb was drawn to the challenge of representing Trump, but his firm refused to let him, largely because Trump was too toxic a client. Cobb agreed to retire from his partnership with his full pension and went to work in the White House as a special legal advisor rather than as one of Trump's personal attorneys. Yet Trump still lacked a big-name, credible Washington attorney on his personal legal team, one with the backing of a powerhouse firm. In an all-hands-on-deck push, Trump's advisors reached out to Ted Olson, A.B. Culvehouse Jr., Emmett Flood, Robert Jifra, Paul Clement, and Dan Levin. All of them followed Sullivan's lead, giving a polite no. Flood had been considering the team's request that he join them, but as the president's White House advisor. In a call in the first week of June, Flood was surprised to hear the team was considering setting up shop in the Eisenhower Executive Office Building, as Bannon planned, for an on-site war room. Working from the White House grounds would look inappropriate, both for the president and for his private team, but Flood made his warning plainer. "That is absolutely insane," he said. Bo thought he found the perfect recruit in Dan Levin, a white-collar pro who had worked as Mueller's chief of staff at the FBI and the Justice Department, and who had turned down Mueller's request to join his special counsel team. Levin had warned Mueller about hiring aggressive prosecutors like Andrew Weissman because he thought they might seek a scalp and push to make a case, even if the facts didn't merit prosecution. Levin wasn't a Trump supporter, but felt strongly that even unpopular people deserved lawyers. But Levin's firm didn't want Trump as a client. For those hunting for a lawyer for the president, the most memorable contender, the one that got away, was Reid Weingarten. The longtime partner at Steptoe & Johnson, Weingarten was a legend because of his uncanny ability at trial to simultaneously woo the jury, eviscerate the government's star witness, and cultivate a fan worship among some of the prosecutors he whooped. One of his billionaire clients, the Las Vegas casino mogul Steve Wynn, told Trump he had to meet Weingarten. "He's the best. I love the guy." Weingarten was a lifelong independent, a social progressive, and close friends with Eric Holder, President Obama's first attorney general. He told his recruiters that he doubted he could represent Trump. He agreed ultimately to talk with Trump in June, however, explaining to White House counsel Don McGahn that he did not feel he could turn down a president's request to meet. Weingarten had a folksy charm and, at times, a mouth like a sailor, giving him and the president a small bit of common ground when they met in the Oval Office. As he did with most of the lawyers, Trump went through a well-worn checklist of questions about how this kind of investigation worked, all of which were softballs for Weingarten, who had cut his teeth as a public corruption prosecutor for many years. Trump wanted to know, what was Mueller up to? What would he be looking at? Trump would later tell confidants he was shocked by Weingarten's answer. By now, Mueller would certainly have copies of Trump's tax returns, likely going back at least 5 or 10 years. This was a basic request any prosecutor would make for anyone under investigation for potential conflicts, the lawyer explained. Trump also asked Weingarten two questions he had been asking other attorneys in recent days. Could Trump pardon his family members? Could he pardon himself? Weingarten declined to describe his meeting with the president, yet Trump told others that Weingarten warned him he might be technically able to, but this legally dubious method would amount to political suicide. At the end of their meeting, the two men parted amiably, if awkwardly. Trump still wasn't entirely sure he needed a criminal defense lawyer. After all, the president believed he hadn't committed any crimes. "Thanks, Reed," the president said. "If I smell trouble, when I smell the jail cell, I'll call you." Then the lawyer was gone. Weingarten met with McGahn for a post-brief after his sit-down with Trump. As McGahn would tell a few close allies, the seasoned lawyer warned him he had just one critical job now: do not let the president remove Mueller. Although Weingarten did not end up working for Trump, the president would repeatedly mention to his aides how much he liked him and recalled details from their conversation. Ordinarily, for a veteran of the white-collar defense bar, representing a president would be a prestigious career capstone. Not so with Trump, however. These high-profile attorneys understood that many people who have an affiliation with Trump ultimately get discarded and diminished. He saw his attorneys as tools to help bend the law for him and to protect him as he took suspect or outright illegal actions. Then there was the issue of money. No one in Trump's orbit could provide clear answers about who would pay. And Trump had a history of stiffing professionals, be they lawyers or construction contractors. What's more, Trump had a reputation for being a notoriously stubborn client. As one lawyer who said no to Trump's offer explained, "It's like being the captain of the Titanic. Turn left, turn left. No, no, I'm going straight." Trump was incensed that Comey was going to testify before Congress on June 8th. He did not understand how a man he fired 1 month earlier could discredit him on premium television airtime. Trump's lawyers began studying whether the president's conversations with Comey could be shielded by executive privilege. Beau had done some preparation by calling Flood, who said he was willing to give him some general advice about asserting executive privilege. Flood told him he would never assert it without the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel first conducting an analysis of whether it was warranted and issuing a legal opinion. Beau thought this sounded complicated and time-consuming. Comey was going to testify in a few days. "Sorry, those are the norms," Flood said. "That's just the way it works." Trump's team decided not to try to block Comey from testifying. Trump watched the hearing on live television from his dining room off the Oval Office, surrounded by Kasowitz, Beau, Sekulow, and other aides. He got angrier by the second, and even before Comey finished, the president howled that Kasowitz had to hold a news conference that afternoon, rebutting everything Comey had said. A free-for-all drafting party then began, with the president barking out the language Kasowitz should bash Comey with. At one point, Trump suggested that Kasowitz point out that Comey was a liar, but his lawyers said no to ad hominem attacks. As often was the case when aides rushed to satisfy Trump's demands, Kasowitz ended up damaging his reputation with his televised appearance that day at the National Press Club. Speaking from prepared remarks, he inaccurately described key events in the timeline of Comey's memo about Trump's request that he let this go regarding the Flynn investigation. Kasowitz's errors would have been easy to avoid, but he jumped to say what his client wanted. White House advisors thought Kasowitz looked foolish and ill-prepared. As one seasoned white-collar lawyer who had been asked to help recruit attorneys for Trump put it, "That was terrible. I was watching that thinking, how does it advance his client's interests for him to be saying these stupid things? He wasn't prepared. His answers were not good." As they settled into a work pattern with the president, the lawyers increasingly saw Kushner and Ivanka Trump as problems. The kids wandered in and out of strategy sessions about the investigation without so much as a knock on the door, asking what was going on. Ivanka would walk in, say, "Hi, Dad," and the lawyers would stop talking about substance and simply smile at her awkwardly, waiting for her to leave. She and Kushner talked openly about details of the investigation with other staffers, as well as with the president, and privately offered him their own advice. "The kids are always there," Carollo later explained. "The discomfort is with the kids always being there and talking about the case with other people in the White House, which makes everybody a witness." "The dynamic," he added, "makes it impossible for the White House to function in a normal way." Bannon and Priebus had warned Kasowitz and Beau back in May about the problems created by having the president's daughter and son-in-law working in the White House in the midst of a special counsel investigation. McGahn shared their concerns, but the kids wanted to be part of the action, and they wanted the lawyers on their side. They worked to charm Dowd, who was immediately taken by Ivanka as she profusely thanked him for joining the legal team and remarked about how valuable he would be to her father. Others who interacted with Ivanka found her to be a spoiled princess who had absorbed her father's worst narcissistic, superficial, and self-promoting qualities. "As a 12-year-old, she was put on the phone with CEOs, and her father told her she was the most amazing thing in the world and her opinion was valued," one administration official explained. "She is a product of her environment." As the lawyers for Trump, his family members, and his business began poring over Trump campaign records in mid-June, they were finding no evidence that linked the president to any coordination or collaboration with Russians. But they did find issues with Kushner. The presidential son-in-law had failed to disclose all of his meetings with foreign officials, and specifically Russians, in his required government forms. He had had more than 100 in-person meetings or phone calls with representatives of more than 20 countries, many of them between Trump's election and inauguration. A failure to include every foreign contact the first time that a senior White House official applied for a security clearance was serious and might nix someone's chances at a job, but it could be excused if there were mitigating circumstances. A failure to fully correct the mistake by disclosing all additional contacts a second time, as was the case with Kushner, would likely disqualify an official from public service in normal circumstances. Kushner retained a renowned white-collar defense attorney, Abby Lowell, to represent him. Lowell had defended many high-profile clients, including Senators Robert Menendez on charges of public corruption and John Edwards on charges of campaign finance fraud, and had been chief counsel to the House Democrats during impeachment proceedings against President Clinton. Although Lowell was a Democrat, he had just the kind of resume Trump would have liked leading his own legal defense. On June 13th, Beau, Dowd, Sekulow, and Carollo gathered at the Washington offices of Kasowitz's firm just two blocks from the White House to discuss the kids. Sekulow broached the subject the team was wrestling over. Should Jared and Ivanka be in the White House? Some of the lawyers were wary of staking out a position. They wanted to maintain their standing with the president, and they figured that whatever they advised Trump to do about the kids, he would share with Kushner and Ivanka, and then they would be roadkill, as one of the advisors put it. Still, in the confines of Kasowitz's law office, they were frank with one another about the challenges created by the presidential family members. Carollo said he worried that Kushner could make other staffers witnesses in the investigation and that he would not be able to assert privilege to protect conversations he had with them. Carollo also argued that Kushner's security clearance problems alone made it impossible for him to remain a true advisor in the White House. The politics are really bad, he said. Bo said the legal team should at least prepare for the possibility that their departure might be necessary. And Sekulow agreed they needed to be ready to discuss the pros and cons with Trump. Prepare some talking points if it comes to pass that we need to recommend it, Sekulow said. But Dowd defended Kushner and Ivanka, stressing that Trump relied on them and the lawyers shouldn't get involved. We're not going to get between family, Dowd said.